Here's the next one. How many times can professing Christians fall? Okay, I counted Peter's sins. That. So in Luke 9:46 and 22:24, I found him arguing. I found the disciples arguing about who is going to be the greatest, and I'm assuming Peter's there. His unbelief. I find that manifest in Matthew 14:31. You remember he was sinking in the water, and Matthew 16:23, get behind me, Satan. Matthew 26:40, 43, 45, he was asleep when Jesus was telling him he ought to be praying. He chopped off Malchus's ear. There were three denials. Galatians 2, Paul has to rebuke him. So I count 12, so apparently you can fall 12 times. Beyond that, you're probably on shaky ground. Okay, next question. Worldly Christians. But let me ask you something. Why would somebody ask that question? I would say, on what basis does that matter? And what I did was I was imagining different scenarios where I have thought about the frequency of sin in somebody's life. Now, you may ask just from a theological standpoint, like on Judgment Day, what is the most sinful Christian of all? There is going to be one. There is going to be the guy or the gal on Judgment Day that is a genuine Christian who sinned as a Christian more than anybody else. How many times could it be? Well, you know, why are we asking? Are we asking because we're somehow interested in that, who that's going to be? Or is it because I find myself falling and I'm kind of concerned about that? Like, can I fall that much? Or it might be not so much me. It might be that some guy comes along and wants to marry Joy. Now I'm asking him why. Because I'm vetting the guy. Like, if he's falling regularly into sin, do I want that guy to marry my daughter? And so, and then look, as a pastor in the church, there's times where church membership is an issue. Or the guy's asking for baptism, which we kind of join together. The guy comes into the church then. But we might be asking on that basis. And that comes up among the elders. You know, if a guy's wanting to join the church, but there's some frequency of sin in his life. And then you go to the other end of this, like church discipline. So how much does a guy have to sin while he's in the church before we actually exercise discipline? So, I mean, you've got all these kind of... And then you know what? You get people, even in the church, who haven't been disciplined yet. I'll tell you this, when you all recognize that when you find people that have this certain form of godliness but deny the power thereof, what are you supposed to do with people like that? You're supposed to avoid them. And I'll tell you what, sometimes you can get people in the church that fit that description, but the elders haven't put them out yet. And you have to make determinations for it. So fellowship, or it may just be you have a concern for somebody's soul. You know, we should have a concern for one another's souls. We kind of watch each other. We are our brother's keepers. And so here we are in the church, and one of the ways you love one another is you're going to rebuke them for sin. You're going to seek to correct where there's sin. And so there's a lot of different basis upon which we might ask this question about how much. And I just, you know, when I think about this, I ask, okay, what is the real issue here? Is it a frequency thing, or is there a deeper matter? And look, I think a lot of this just boils down to what does our Bible teach us about what genuine Christianity is? And that's important. You got that I said what our Bibles teach us? Folks, there are theological systems out there that I think are unreliable, including sometimes reform systems, Calvinistic systems. There are certain teachers in certain circles that they may be accurate in some of their teaching, but brethren, I'll just say this, that I remember that Charles Leiter was accused of over-realized soteriology by folks at the Louisville, the seminary there in Louisville, Southern. And why? All he was doing was teaching what the New Testament said about Christianity, and he was being charged with presenting Christianity as overly victorious. That's what over-realized soteriology, over-realized doctrine of salvation, that he was setting it forth as too victorious. That is common, folks. You can trace this all the way back to the beginning of the Reformation. You can go back to the days of the Anabaptists, and they accused the reformers of denying the necessity of practical righteousness. The Anabaptists did not, by and large. And I know there were fringe groups among the Anabaptists, but as a whole, that was one of the things that they recognized and accused the reformers of, is basically this whole thing about defeated Christianity. Woe is me. Woe. It's just downplaying what a saint is and what the scriptures really teach about the radical nature of... We have to be careful there. Listen, whoever, this is the way the ESV reads, 1 John 3:8, whoever makes a practice of sinning is of the devil, for the devil has been sinning from the beginning. Now listen to this, the reason the Son of God, this is the context, it's got to do with the practice of sinning. Whoever makes a practice of sinning is of the devil. The reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the works of the devil. Well, in that context, what in the world is he talking about? He's talking about us and a practice of sin in our lives. And he goes on to say, John does, no one born of God makes a practice of sinning. So if you've been born again, if you haven't been born again, you're not going to inherit the kingdom, folks. You've been born again, if you've been born again, what does it say? People that have been born again, people that have been born of God, no one born of God makes a practice of sinning, for God's seed abides in him, and he cannot keep on sinning because he has been born of God. That's radical language. But what are you going to do with it? I mean, you don't want to dismiss it. By this is evident who are the children of God and who are the children of the devil. Whoever does not practice righteousness is not of God, nor is the one who does not love his brother. So, I mean, you have these statements in Scripture. What do we do? Now, I think of the text, especially the way that the King James and the New King James states this. It's a text that comes out of 1 Thessalonians 5. We exhort you, brethren, warn those who are unruly, comfort the faint-hearted, uphold the weak. I've often resorted to that text because I recognize that within the church, like we talked about the guy on Judgment Day who is going to have committed more sin than any other true child of God, I have always recognized that there are unruly, there are faint-hearted, and there are weak Christians in the church. And I think that the most unruly, the most faint, the most weak of all of God's people through all of the ages, when we come to Judgment Day, if that person happened to be in our church, we would think they're lost. Because they're that weak, they're that faint, and they're that unruly. We would think that. And so we want to be careful. And you know what scripture says? You want to be careful that you're not trying to set yourself up as the salvation police where you do what Jesus said we shouldn't do. What did Jesus say we shouldn't do?
Leave the stairs alone.
Yeah, he doesn't want us being these tear policemen that are coming along looking for the chaff, looking for the tares, looking for the weeds, and we're constantly trying to pull them all up. You know, oh, look at that. She didn't do this. And did you hear the way he talked to his wife? I mean, you're constantly sniffing around. You're trying to find all the fakes in the church. The fakes are there. And you know what? Some of them would be discovered at the end. Some of them are discovered along the way because of their ungodly lifestyle. We got to get the leaven out. And so we got to have our eyes open to the leaven. If the leaven's obvious. But the thing is, there's a place to take people at their word. And brethren, I would just say this, that you know what? We can't see into somebody's mind. But I would say this about yourself. And even as I think about somebody, see, for me, letting somebody into the church membership is a low risk thing. We might be bringing some leaven in, but we basically examine their life. We can always put them out of the church if it's deemed necessary in the future. That, to me, that seems low risk. Marrying my daughter, that's high risk. I mean, I'm gonna examine that more. But your own soul. And I just say this to you. Look, one of the things that Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount is he talked about prayer, he talked about fasting, he talked about almsgiving. And you know what? He emphasized what we do when no one else can see. Like he was emphasizing a Christianity that is lived in secret. You give in secret, you pray in secret, you fast in secret. And I just ask you this, who are you really? Who are you when nobody's watching? What's your relationship like with God? How do you deal with sin? Are you ashamed? Do you live in the presence of God? Do you confess your sin? Do you know something of the cleansing and the sprinkling of his blood upon your conscience? And you go to him in prayer and you confess the dirt and the garbage and the failures. I mean, how does it make you feel as you commune with him? Not just that it's mechanical and you go down through this thing because you have to, but you actually commune with him and you have a sense that your sin impedes your relationship with him. And you don't want that. You want his smile. You want his closeness. And in secret, you groan and you speak to him and you confess and you talk and you weep and you feel so thankful for Christ and for his shed blood. And I mean, what are you in? Are you that in secret? I mean, that person's not going to be ashamed in the end. But if that's not you, if it's like the hypocrite always is doing everything for the external appearance. He comes to church, he's always concerned about, look, every one of us are concerned about how we look to other, we're aware when we're among other people. I'm not going to pick my nose up here, but you've all picked your nose. I mean, there's certain, we regulate our behavior. But I'm saying just the reality of it, behind the scenes, when nobody else can see, who are you then? Because I guarantee you this, what you are there is what you really are. So, any comments on that one?
In my experience and dealings with people and talking to them, I feel like it's not necessarily how many times or how deep into the sin, but it's what the response is when there's actual recognition of the sin and the reality of your sin before God. And, thinking of the proverb, you know, righteous man falling seven times and coming, getting up, because it's because of that, the truth that hits you and how do you respond to that. I think a lot of times that is telling when there's no life, it's just going to be like, oh yeah, I shouldn't do that. And then you continuing in it because there's no inner real conviction and turning in your heart. So it's just all mind.
Yeah, there doesn't seem to be the kind of transparency with God. Because the thing is, the guy that's not real it's the hypocrite. It's the guy that puts the mask on. And they are so adept at the mask, they mask themselves in any kind of communion with God as well. And so typically those people are striving after a religion that is man-made. They live on self-righteousness, and they're self-righteous before God. Just like that Pharisee, remember how he prayed, "I think that I'm not like this tax collector over here, and I do this, and I do that, and I do that." And that's basically the mindset. In private, they're like, "Well, you know, I do this, and I do that, and I do that." And the person that believes that God is, and he's a rewarder of them that diligently seek him, I mean, their approach to him, they have a sense of his holiness, they have a sense of his purity, but they also have a sense that he is loving, and he sent his son, and that there is forgiveness, and that, I think the genuine Christian finds himself exposed to devilish attacks, where when we fail, the devil comes along and says, "Christ doesn't want anything to do with you. You have no business going to him. You need to do penance." And so there's this. I don't think that the hypocrite deals with that. The hypocrite is striving to work out something that's acceptable before God, so that he's going to be accepted on those terms. But